Section number 7266, Reel 2.
General Lloyd, Reel 2. General, you were saying you went to the Staff College on the first course organised for Territorial Army officers in 1939. Can I ask you what you studied while you were there?
The Staff College course was, in my opinion, a supremely excellent course. As I've already told you, I was at the University of Cambridge for something like 7 years, and during that time I'd been on other courses of varying types. But never had I encountered the efficiency which characterised the whole of the Staff College course. We all of us were basically civilians, and we had the highest regard for
instructors.
Yes, the content, the structure, the method of instruction, all of them, in our opinion, and I'm sure I'm speaking for the whole of this course as well as for myself, were of the very highest quality. Now, to come to what was taught, the first part of the course was devoted to... this particular staff course, which I know now was unique in many respects. It was certainly the first Territorial Army one, and the syllabus was specially concocted for that purpose. We were all basically civilians, and I discovered after I'd been there for about a fortnight that every member of the course was not only well qualified from a military point of view, but also well qualified academically. I think I'm right in saying that everyone had a university degree or the equivalent. I suppose that I must have learned this by talking in the mess about Cambridge. The content of the course was the first quarter was basic army administration, which was in those days called staff duties. We would now probably call it organisation and administration. And it also dealt with the content of in those days, the manual of
military law.
Yes, the manual of military law, and there was also a book which I believe Archie Wavell wrote when he was a G1 in the War Office.
Field Service Regulations?
Field Service Regulations, FSR Vol 1 and Vol 2. Well, that constituted one quarter of the course. The other three quarters were based on the activities, operational and otherwise, of a division. The first one we dealt with was a division in the attack. We next dealt with a division in retreat. No, sorry, that's wrong. The second one was a division in defence. And the last one, which we were told afterwards was never again to be repeated, we dealt with a division in the retreat. I think the reasons for saying that it would never be repeated are pretty obvious. But I myself found that the content of the course in the division of the retreat was much more interesting than any of the others, for the simple reason that we now know that to conduct a retreat satisfactorily requires a much higher degree of command and control than either a division in the attack or a division in defence. However, now to turn to the method. The method by which these three operations of a division were taught was only marginally by lecture. It was mainly by tactical exercise, that is to say, members of the course were designated as the commanding general, the general staff officer grade one, the administrative officer, the AA and QMG, and so on. We used to form small teams representing a divisional staff and of course the brigade staffs and the supporting artillery brigade and the sappers and the signals, and we either fought a mock battle in the college itself, or we went out onto the ground, the area around Camberley, and fought a mock battle, either taking a division into the attack or in defence or in retreat.
This would have been in the area of places like Barossa Common.
That's right, that's right. We went actually, though, in those days, we went pretty far afield. I remember an approach march which took us right down to Salisbury. That's when we were being taught how to handle large masses of artillery and tanks, and having to cross over the approach march lines of other sister divisions on either flank.
This is a problem of march techniques.
Yes, that's right.
It's interesting you should have mentioned tanks. Did you do very much work on the use of tanks?
Yes, we did. Yes. Tanks were obviously regarded by the staff of that particular course as being very much a weapon of the then modern era of warfare. We never got so far as to, I don't remember, handling an armoured division. More normally, we were taught to handle an army tank brigade.
So that would be a brigade attached to a division.
A brigade attached to a division, yes. I think, if my memory serves right, an army tank brigade in those days were regarded as core troops, and they were allotted to a division according to the role that it was destined to play.
Were the tanks, it was assumed, to have infantry support tanks, or were they cruisers and light tanks?
I don't think we... This may seem a very strange thing to say, but I don't think we ever handled infantry close support tanks. They were nearly all cruisers or light tanks.
Do you remember how it was intended to employ them, how you taught to employ them?
Well, of course, this is rather overlaid by subsequent experience in encountering a panzer division. The panzer division under blitzkrieg tactics were simply given an axis of advance, and the tank simply stormed ahead along a general axis. In contrast with that, the method we were taught was a very, very deliberate method of approach, using main objectives and a whole series of intermediate objectives. And I well remember a major in the Scots Greys who was in my syndicate, who always argued that this was a ghastly mistake and that most of the tanks would be spending their times huddled up in groups and being subject to harassing artillery fire. His name, incidentally, was Anstruther Gough Grey, Gough Kelthorpe. Anstruther Gough Kelthorpe. He was the Army's champion squash player.
Did you consider the effects of close cooperation with aircraft?
Yes, we did. In fact, the method of communication between infantry and the RAF was just in its infancy, and it was during the period of that particular staff course that the method of communication which was to be used in World War II was, to begin with at any rate, was first envisaged, and we were the first people to be taught it.
What was this method?
It was the strip method. If I remember rightly, there were canvas strips which were laid out on the ground with indicator letters which had a meaning for the infantry and the RAF, such as, for example, pointing out the limits of what we called in those days our forward defended localities. That was the jargon, the FDL, the forward defended locality. And, of course, indicating the direction of infantry advance, the location of the enemy, and so on.
Did you actually practice this in the field?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. We used to take these things out during our toots, and we used to practice laying out the canvas, and the RAF used to overfly us and indicate later on whether they'd got the gist of the message that we were trying to indicate.
Did you ever have aircraft cooperating while you were actually putting attacks into?
Yes, we did. The aircraft were usually Lysanders, because the drill was that the Lysander would imitate an RAF reconnaissance plane at a fairly moderate height, and when the exercise was over, the Lysander would land close to us. The pilot and observer would get out and would come across and have a conference with us. And I believe that our course was the first time that had ever been done.
Now, while you were on this course, the war was approaching.
Yes.
When did you realised that it was imminent and unavoidable?
Oh, I think I can say with considerable certainty that we embarked on the course knowing that war would probably take place in the autumn of autumn of 1939. Autumn, of course, as you well know, is the usual time for a war to start, and we were quite certain that we were going to be participants in a war that was going to start, we thought, in about September 1939.
Had you any idea how it would start.
I find that extremely difficult to answer because my recollections of that time are very much overshadowed by the actuality of what did in fact happen. If I told you that we envisaged Poland being overrun and so on, I think I should probably be misleading you. The general ethos, if I might use that word, of our staff course was very much in the French staff tradition. That is to say, we imagined the Maginot Line as being invincible. I think, although I'm not quite sure, that we envisaged the French army as attacking Germany from the western flank of the Maginot Line. And conducting an outflanking manoeuvre on what would be the right flank of a German army. However, as I say, it's a very, very difficult question to answer. That is, certainly we had no idea at all of the blitzkrieg tactics which the Germans, in fact, used against us. If I might now, because my thoughts are oriented that way, if I might now leap ahead to the period when we were in France during the so-called Battle of France, we had the same thing, same feeling then. We in the 12th Division were given an opportunity of visiting the Maginot Line, and I was one of those who had the good fortune to go. And certainly the impression that a relatively young officer had in those days, who'd had no previous first-hand battle experience, and it was all theory, the first impression of the Maginot Line was that it was literally impregnable. And I've no doubt at all that that was the general feeling of the French. Although the general feeling, I think, of officers of the regular army in the British Expeditionary Force was that their tactics were those of mobile warfare. And certainly their equipment, for example, the 25-pounder was mounted on rubber tyres. The whole equipment of the BEF, and our own as well for that matter, was much more suitable for a mobile warfare than for a static warfare.
Can I take you back a bit to what happened before you got to France?
Yes.
Now, I understand your course at the Staff College was brought to an end rather abruptly.
Yes, it was.
And what happened to you after you'd finished? I think it was in August, wasn't it? 1939?
Yes, in August. Well, I, as I've already told you, the Territorial Army was being duplicated. I received my staff appointment. I was taken away from my regiment, and I received my staff appointment in I think it was early August 1939. I remember having a short period of leave when the Army Staff College was terminated. And I was at home. I lived in Shoreham in those days, and I was at home on leave. And my actual mobilisation order and my staff appointment was received by me at home. And the appointment was as a GSO2 to divisional headquarters in Sevenoaks. I can remember the exact address. It was Shenden, Weald Road, Sevenoaks. And the appointment was to the headquarters of the 44th Division. When I reported to this headquarters, I found that they were in process of dividing the 44th Divisional Headquarters into two and forming a new divisional headquarters, the 12th Division. And my appointment was changed to the headquarters of 12th Division.
But still as a GSO2.
General Staff Officer Grade 2. At a divisional headquarters, there was one GSO1. That was a Lieutenant Colonel. One administrative officer. He was called the AA and QMG. That's the Assistant Adjutant General and Quartermaster General. He was also a Lieutenant Colonel. The GSO1 had under him one GSO2, General Staff Officer Grade 2, he was a Major, for operations, and one GSO2, also a Major, for intelligence. And the AA and QMG had a Lieutenant Colonel, had a Major for, that's a GSO2, for QMG, Quartermaster's work, and a GSO2 for personnel work, DAAG.
Who did you work for?
I worked, first of all, for Colonel Leader, LEADER. He was the GSO1 of the 12th Division, and I was the GSO Ops. And so that it may go on the record, I remember the AA and QMG was a Lieutenant Colonel Gardam.
What was your main work as GSO Ops?
Training. That was often the case. It was training in peacetime and ops in when active operations started. we had I'm talking about the 12th Division now. We had no artillery, no engineers, and no signals, but we did have three infantry brigades: the 35th Brigade, the 36th Brigade, and the 37th Brigade. The 35th Brigade was all Queen's Royal Regiment. The 36th Brigade was a battalion of the Buffs, I think the 5th Battalion, and the 6th and 7th Battalions of the Royal West Kents. My memory is completely failed as to the composition of the 37th Brigade. I suppose, logically, it would be the entirely composed of West Kents, but my memory has failed on that, and I just can't remember.
What sort of condition were the brigades in?
Well, they were simply skeleton battalions made up of a nucleus of the equivalent battalions in the 44th Division, whose brigade structure was analogous to ours, and the rest were people drafted in from outside. And the standard of general standard of overall training was very low indeed. And we had, oh, by the way, we had no anti-tank weapons. They were simply, the battalions were simply armed with the rifle. In those days, the infantry anti-tank regiment weapon was the two-pounder anti-tank gun, which was very ineffectual, and the 0.45-inch
the boys.
Boys rifle. Both of them completely ineffectual. But, of course, we didn't know this at the time. This is all, you know, after the event.
So what could you do to actually rectify the deficiencies in training and equipment?
Well, nobody could tell us when we could expect to be completely equipped. For example, we were so badly equipped that I was carrying a pistol from civil life. We weren't issued with regulation 0.38 until we got back from France in 1940. All we could do, we knew what we were destined to be equipped with, and all we could do was train in vacuo, so to speak, with simulators for the real thing. However, training was very seriously undertaken, but, of course, in the nature of things, it couldn't be very realistic.
Where was it done?
Oh, in situ. That is, in the area, mainly in Kent, round about Maidstone, Sevenoaks, Maidstone,